Hi, and welcome once again to From the Center, a podcast by the Center for Western Studies. I'm Jack Val, on faculty of the Center for Western Studies, joined, as always, by the loquacious, gregarious director of the Center for Western Studies, John Hodges. Sir,
thank you, sir. Loquacious, huh? I'm going to have to look that one up. I'm
trying to expand my vocabulary. I am in college.
That's great. Well, it's good to see you, Jack.
Good to see you, too, sir.
I'm glad we could get together today. The other day, you seemed frustrated to me. And it seemed to me you'd seen some speeches that gave you some trouble. And I'd love to talk about those if you want to.
Yeah, there were a couple of speeches that happened. Two of them I watched. One was by a Senator Jeff Flake,
his name is.
He gave a speech on the Senate floor where he basically announced his retirement.
Yes, right. He's not going to run again.
His retirement was basically grounded in that, as best I can understand it, the political discourse had gotten so toxic and the Senate wasn't helping. And he basically criticized the president for not helping it. And the gist of it was that, you know, traditional constitutional conservative like Flake has no place in this type of political discourse. It doesn't want to be a part of it, and it can't do anything about it. It felt kind of a noble surrender in a way. It's kind of like in That Hideous Strength when Bellbury's talking about selling the thing, and then Jewel Cannon wants to say something, but they all kind of glare at him, and he just kind of puts his hands up and just puts his head down.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of a sad, noble defeat sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then another speech was that kind of made the news was George W. Bush, that old boogeyman of the left, came out of hiding to give a speech, I think, at the George Bush Institute, whatever that is.
Is it the library in
it might have been the
Dallas?
Library. It might have been the institute within the library.
Okay,
you know, it's a research thing that tries to help solve, like, world problems.
I see.
And he gave a speech, and it was very presidentially sounding speech about the world order and things like that. He took a few implicit shots at the president. I hate to call him shots because he's classier than that, but it definitely felt like he was talking about how our discourse had degraded and something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I remember listening to both of these men, and I remember I felt very, very frustrated and very disillusioned by both of them, which was strange to me. Jeff Flake gave a speech that was about, I mean, yes, it like basically criticized the president, but it was based on this constitutional conservative, we've gotten away from our principles, we don't stand on them anymore, we were our most prosperous when we were our most principled. That's something that he said. And it was a very, something that if I had heard, like, you know, 20 years ago when I was a teenager, anyways, like 15 or 20 years ago when I was a teenager, I would have been like, yes, you know, this is our kind of guy, you know, standing for principles of the Constitution and standing for the dignity of the office. We're not on the side of those Clintonians who have affairs in the office and stuff like that,
kind of thing. Right, right.
And it would have been like that. It would have been something I would have rallied around. Bush's speech would have been something I would have rallied around, that we have to basically stand for democracy and free markets around the world. And we have to bring the light of that to elsewhere to help end tyranny, you know, stuff like that. Again, something 15, 20 years ago I would have, like, rallied around. I found, listening to them now, that they felt very, very kind of, I'm not sure what the word is. I wanted to say hollow.
Hollow.
Jeff Flake's really frustrated me because it sounded extremely idealistic.
Uh-huh.
You know, this kind of, if not, this is not knocking on him, okay?
Sure.
This is not,
sure,
knock
he's
on,
a good man.
I'm not knocking on either of these guys.
Right.
It's just that the speech that Flake gave felt very idealistic and naive about American principles, what America can and cannot do. And Bush's felt not naive because he can say things a bit more presidentially and sounds very strong and solid, but it felt empty. It felt very, it just felt incorrect. Like, no, that's not correct.
Mm-hmm.
There was something about Bush's idea that if we just have this kind of foreign policy and we spread these ideals around this way and so on and so forth, then somehow we're going to save the world. We, specifically being America, but, you know, America-led coalition is going to save the world. And Flake seemed to be, if we just stand on our political principles of, you know, limited government, of individualism, of freedom and stuff, of free market policy, market economics, stuff like that, then somehow America will save itself. That'll be okay. And I found myself as a Christian, I'm not sure if off-put is the right word, but it just, it, like I said, it rang hollow. I look at Bush, and I'm like, no, you can't save the world through, like, foreign policy. And look at Flake and say, no, America can't be fixed by political principle. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not what fixes it. Mm-hmm. What was going on in that moment, this was not just like it just suddenly happened. Like, I was driving to the grocery store and I heard these and this just kind of, you know, popped out of holes in the ground like dwarven women do. But this is something that's been in my mind for the last few years. When Obama was president, there was a similar sort of, if America just kind of does X, Y, and Z, then the whole world will be fixed. Right. You know, if we do this deal with Iran, if we have this sort of policy toward the Arab Spring, everything will be fixed. If we have this kind of domestic policy, everything will be taken care of. If everybody just kind of gets in line this way politically, it'll all be fixed. And I,
so you were seeing some parallels, actually, between the left and the right in their, in the way that they addressed policies by way of government.
Yeah, there was this sense of, like, you know, if we just, it didn't matter.
If we fix the government, somehow we'll fix the problem.
And in the last, like, 18 or so months, 18 or 20 months, which includes the last presidential election, I saw the same thing again. All right, but it was we had Trump and we had Bernie. We're kind of the two dark horse upsetters of the game. Bernie, I think recent news seems to come out that Bernie was legitimately gypped out of the nomination, which would
or at least a good run at it,
or at least a very good run at it. But they were the two that were upsetting everything and toppling everything. And I remember during the campaigns for both of these men, there was this weird sense on either side of the aisle, not with everyone, but there was a weird sense that somehow if we elect our guy, whoever it is, whether it was Bernie or whether it was Trump, if we elect that person, somehow they're going to fix everything. Now, as an American, I was like, that's not true, because that's not how the office of the presidency works. It doesn't have, or it's not supposed to have, that kind of power.
Right.
To just sort of run roughshod over the other form of the other.
We weren't electing a king.
Right. We weren't electing a king. We're electing a president who, within the confines of the Constitution, isn't even the most important branch of the government. Like, the legislator is supposed to be, they're Article One.
Right.
So this, as an American, I was like, no, electing this person is not going to fix everything. But as a Christian, I felt the same way I did about Flake's speech and Bush's speech and about Obama's ideas about this, that this notion that somehow if we just elect the right person, or we elect the right Congress, or we do the right policies, domestic or foreign, that somehow we can save ourselves and we can save the world. We can eliminate poverty and crime and war and tyrants and all kinds. We can, whether they know this or not, they're basically, we can fix the human heart if we do all these things. As a Christian, I'm like, no, you're all wrong. Like, you're all completely, utterly wrong. That's not how this works. You can't do it, okay?
Yeah.
And what was weird is that for the last few years, I've been slowly kind of articulating that, understanding that, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's actually probably a good thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think it's actually healthy to recognize the limits, maybe, of what politics can do in the human heart and mind and life. And if the goal is the good life, as we're told, you know, from Aristotle, but especially informed by the Bible, what the good life is supposed to be like, there are probably several different kinds of policies or governments or whatever that could assist in accomplishing that, but they can't accomplish it themselves. It's, you know, politics just doesn't have the scope to be able to deal with the real problem that human beings have, which is sin, of course.
I think it's that understanding of, like, the lack of scope. That's a good thing. It's good to recognize.
Yeah, recognize that. It seems like, maybe you agree, it seems like a lot of the debates that go on nowadays about any issue is about how politics can fix that issue.
Yes.
But the assumption is, without the tacit assumption, is that politics is the answer.
Yes, and I think that's the thing that's been, over the last maybe 12 or 18 months, that's actually been more frustrating. Like I said, the last few years, I've been understanding this. And that's, like, it's good. It's fine. Honestly, it's, I think you said one day it's healthy. It's like it's good to understand that kind of limitations of politics.
Right.
Especially politics that are made and run by fallen human beings.
Yeah, especially.
But I suppose lately what frustrated me is I listened to Flake and Bush and I was like, my goodness, they were supposed to be my guys.
Right, right.
Like that's right. Where I was supposed to stand with like Flake, constitutional conservative. I don't remember if he was a Tea Party candidate or not, but yeah. He may have been very friendly with them. Suddenly, like, I'm like, no. And, yeah. Like, Bush, yeah. Like, you know, I didn't agree with a lot of what he did in a lot of ways, but he was a good man. He was a classy president, and his vision was one I would have been like, yeah, some time ago. And now I'm like, no.
Yeah.
And then there's people today, people I know and care about, who like friends and such, who and others who are like, well, Trump is the one who's going to solve everything.
Uh-huh.
He's going to get in there and he's going to fight for us and he's going to fix everything and he's going to do it. First of all, I have my doubts whether he's actually going to be able to do that. But second of all, even if he was this brilliant sort of fighter who's going to fight for us, he's not the solution.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He's not. He really isn't. The presidency is not the solution to the problems of a nation. It just isn't. And I guess what was frustrating me is this feeling that I used to, politically speaking, I used to belong somewhere.
Yeah,
I used to belong like with these politicians and these ideas or something like that. Even when when Bush was president, the first time I was able to vote was in 2004. I voted for Bush because that's what my family did. Republican and free markets and whatever and fight the terrorists. It was like just standard stuff. McCain came around. By that point, I didn't really care for him. I was like, yeah, whatever. But I could tell that Obama, for whatever anybody thinks about him, I just saw him as like an empty suit. He just was like, yeah, this is a guy who has no experience, and he's just riding a wave of hype and nostalgia and this idealism, and not on anything about policy or principle or anything like that. And that's no good. You need something that actually has some substance to it. And he seemed very insubstantial rather than just like a gloss. But McCain was nobody I was like on board with completely. And Romney was kind of the same way.
Sure.
But I noticed more and more that as I was like, well, these guys really aren't that good. A lot of people around me were just like, suddenly, like, they're the second coming of Reagan or something like that. Uh-huh. And I was like, no, they're not. And even Reagan probably wasn't a perfect candidate. And the more and more it went along, it was just like there was less place for me to stand. Like, this last one with Trump was probably the first election where I really did not go with what would have been normally the things I would go with.
Yeah.
I went third party on it, mainly because we're in Tennessee, and I knew Tennessee was going to go to Trump, so there was really nothing else I could do.
Didn't want Hillary, but you didn't want Trump either.
Right, so it was really this sense of, like, I didn't belong anywhere. And and that is, as somebody who likes, as a true conservative, which means I like the idea of a clear sense of belongingness. Mm. Here is clearly where you fit. That was very frustrating to me, because it seemed like I was now kind of isolated from a whole bunch of things, even people I care about or agree with or something like that. I now felt kind of cut off. And so it started making me wonder, what really is a truly Christian vision of politics? Because it seems like we as an entire nation have gotten sucked up. Even people in the church seem to have gotten sucked up into this notion that it's the politics that'll fix things. I've mentioned this before in things I've written when I talk about the Christian Coalition or the Moral Majority and stuff that happened back in like the 70s and 80s.
Uh-huh.
I do not want to knock those things at all because I don't doubt their sincerity. All right? I don't. Maybe someone can prove that to me otherwise, but for now I'm saying I don't doubt their sincerity. I just question the tactics, that somehow there was this implication, if there's this cultural decay that's going on, the way we fight it is through politics.
Right.
Is by electing people and pushing agendas and policies.
It does seem like you're offering the same solution, only different policies within the solution. The lack is that we're asking politics to do something that it never was really intended to do.
Right.
That's that scope point I was trying to make earlier. Just that We assume that in a plurality like this, we can't possibly agree on religious terms.
Right.
So what we have in common is our political public square, and right. And in that public square, all we can hope to do is make our policies accomplish our ends. Well, it doesn't work that way. I mean, that's not really how politics works anyway. You were saying, having a president voted in is somehow going to fix things. You could say it. Many people said it about Obama. Many people said it about Trump. Many people hoped for Hillary to step in and fix things, I think, or at least continue what President Obama had been doing. All with this idea that somehow politics and who's in charge, who's in the White House, is going to be the solution for our social ills, our cultural ills, our civilization.
Right.
But it, actually, I think the who we put in the White House is the fruit of our thoughts and not the root of it.
Right.
It's not going to become a cause that's going to take over and run the country in the right direction. It's actually just a way for us to see what it is we as a group really do believe. And what we believe, I think, today is pretty clear. That is that it may be that this country was founded in a time when a Christian view of the world was still the prevalent view, prevailing view, so that there was a God who made the world and that made sense of it for us through his revelation, and that we ought to be serious about our moral lives, if not our spiritual lives in general. And the Enlightenment was an attempt, really, to get the spiritual and the mythological and the mysterious and the magical and the miraculous, all of that off the table and right. only deal with the sort of practical, rational stuff
right.
of life. And so this kind of politics really is the fruit of that kind of thinking. We're living in a material world, and so we need material solutions for the what may very well be not material, non-material problems.
That's probably the other side of the frustration, is that swimming in the progressivist circles that I do and like my university and stuff like that, there's a lot of them that are big on not tolerating the notion of American exceptionalism.
Oh, yeah.
That America is not exceptional, that it's actually, if it's not just basically another system, a different system of government that's no better or worse than others, it is, if it's not just that, it's, greedy, exploitative, and the source of all ills. But at the very least, it's, just a different form of government. I don't believe that. I believe that the Constitution that we created, that our founders created, is probably the greatest political document and system that human beings have ever created.
Right. Right? I think so, too.
There is none better so far.
But that doesn't mean necessarily that it is the solution for all problems, right? And because this is the thing. You've said it really already, but the reality is the problem is a spiritual problem, and you can't fix a spiritual problem with material ends, with material means, rather.
Right.
So what we believe is upstream from how we build our culture. Our culture is the reflection of what we believe.
Right.
And our politics turns out to be the reflection and downstream from what our culture holds and exhibits. So you can't step into the stream at the point of politics and work back and change people's beliefs. It does happen a little. There are eddies that kind of, but it's like 90% in one direction, 10% in the other. So that 90% of it is that we believe certain things, we embody those beliefs in our culture, and then our culture makes those beliefs plausible to us.
Right.
And from that, we end up electing people because what seems plausible. That's why it is that everybody on both sides of the aisle seem to think it plausible to argue that politics can actually change the way our society is going to be run.
Right.
You can't elect somebody and then have him change the way people believe. But it's plausible because we've been taught for so long that there isn't a transcendent reality, that the highest reality is really the culture that we've built and the politics that come out of that culture.
Right.
So you hear people say we have a terrible poverty problem. The church hasn't been able to solve that poverty problem itself. So we need something bigger. We need a bigger machine. And the politics, the government, is that machine to be able to pull that off. Well, I think it was never intended to do that. It's like using a... It's using a hammer to put a screw in the wall. It's using the wrong tool. So, but people have bought into that so much that now all the debates are not about whether politics can or can't fix the problem, but this policy is going to be a better policy than that. And so you split everybody left and right. The sort of socialist policies are going to be actually better for us, or the what Marx probably called capitalist policies, or what we might want to say free market. I think you use that term. Free market is a better term. Laissez-faire small government kind of thing is going to solve it. But in both cases, we're saying this kind of government is going to bring about the world, the good of the world. When Bush, I think George, I like George Bush in many ways, and I think he's a serious Christian in his own way, but I think he's mistaken about a few things.
Yeah.
And one of the things I think he was mistaken about is his optimism about the democracy in Iraq bringing about a peaceful Iraq.
Yeah.
And I think even he would have to agree now that it was a little utopian from the right.
Yeah.
We argue, you and I argue a lot of times, against the notion of a kind of socialist utopia from the left,
right?
But it's possible, isn't it, to argue for a sort of laissez-faire democracy utopia from the right?
Definitely is. When I read some of the right, the Foundation for Economic Education.
Yep.
It's a libertarian group. And they argue for free markets, and I like them because they can articulate really well. It's a really serious kind of publication.
Mm-hmm.
But I noticed that they believe in it wholesale. Like their moral center comes from free markets, that the idea of self-interest isn't just a way to run like an economic model. It's actually a way to create a sort of moral culture.
Oh, yeah, right.
Now, to their credit, it's kind of built on the idea that you can't be happy unless you're good.
Uh-huh.
You know, so it's the idea like your self-interest isn't really met unless you cooperate and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
Still, I would look at that as a Christian and be like, if you put self-interest at the center, you only need to be good so long as it serves your self-interest until you can finally transcend that and set up enough of an apparatus to where you can serve your self-interest and not be good. You know, your brand,
which is really what we've been doing.
Right. Your brand name is so big that it doesn't really matter. This is probably a totally fictitious example. I'm just saying, you find out tomorrow that Apple's been like using sweatshops to like build all their products, and that blast all across it. Apple, you know, child labor and sweatshop. Do you think Apple's going to lose any money or productivity?
Right.
Now, their brand's huge. It's everywhere. It's ubiquitous. Sure. They have set it up, you know, to where it doesn't matter anymore. And you mentioned, you know, there's like a mistake, like George Bush is mistaken. I think that cuts back to like the idea of belief, you know, that there's mistaken beliefs that
absolutely
that are, I think you said the word tacit is a good one. It's just sort of assumed. You don't really think about it. It's just there already. You talked about the poverty question. You said that trying to use the government over the church to solve it is like using, you know, a hammer in a screw, like using the wrong tool. You could argue that the very notion that we can solve poverty is itself
a problem.
That's
absolutely.
Now you're not just trying to hammer a screw into a wall. You're trying to hammer a screw into a leak to try and plug it up. And it's not only you're using the wrong tool, you're not even doing the right thing in the first place.
Procedure itself is mistaken.
This, you know, could be a discussion for another podcast someday. But like, do we take seriously Jesus's statement that you will always have the poor?
Yeah, yeah.
And the thing is that we all live in the shadow of an Enlightenment belief. And the right and the left both agree on this, okay? And it doesn't matter whether you're a Marxist socialist. It doesn't matter if you're a laissez-faire libertarian type. It doesn't matter even if you're like a fascist authoritarian type, like an alt-right side or something like that. All of you, in some way, shape, or form, at the back of it, believe that the highest good and the ultimate good is the complete and utter emancipation of the individual.
Uh-huh.
All right? Now, you may have different definitions of who the individual is and who the individual counts. I'm sure, like, a white nationalist would have a very specific definition of what individual is.
Mm-hmm.
But still, fundamentally, it's the complete and utter emancipation of the individual from everything that stops them, okay? Whether you want to say it's government forces that get in the way the most, so we have to remove them and get them out of the way, whether you think it's communal forces that get in the way of the most. Evil corporations get in the way. A disease and stuff. Right. Why not have universal health care? It will emancipate the individual. Now they don't have to worry about your lack of education is a thing. Let's emancipate people from that.
Sure.
You know,
give everybody free education.
All that red tape that gets thrown over your small business, that all that stuff, let's just emancipate you from that. Roll back the government. Mm-hmm. There's this implicit idea of the emancipation of the individual against everything and all comers. The Bush doctrine and the Obama doctrine both come down on that. We have to imagine whether it's Bush trying to advocate for and trying to go for spreading democracy and free markets around the world,
right,
or whether it's Obama, people like Obama and David Cameron who tried to like force Uganda to, you know, not vote on their sodomy laws. They basically tried to force LGBT right issues on another country or something like that.
Sure.
Regardless,
sure,
the attitude is the same. The highest good is the utter and complete emancipation of the individual. And if you're a Christian, if you're a Christian, you have a qualified problem with that. I say qualified because it's not like you're now a collectivist. Even in some paradoxical way, collectivism is a way to emancipate the individual, because now the individual doesn't have to worry about everything because the collective now takes care of it.
Right, right.
It's not a denial of like the individual person, that they somehow are matter and unique in and of themselves. It's not wanting to deny that, but denying that the good for the individual person is emancipation in the first place, or total emancipation.
That's it, isn't it? Actually, that's diabolical in the end, isn't
right.
it? Isn't that really what the temptation in the garden was about? Mm-hmm. The devil says to Eve, did he really say that? You can call your own shots. You can be emancipated. You can be autonomous. You can be a law unto yourself, and which is, I think, on both sides, what you're talking about.
It was the temptation in the desert, too.
It was, wasn't it?
Sure. When the devil came to Jesus, I mean, everything he did was like, take it in your own hands, right?
Right.
Take it into your own hands. If you do this, that, or the other, you'll get everything. Just, you know, this is a way for you to take it in your own hands.
Make these stones into bread. Throw yourself off of the battlement there. All of that. If our culture has that in common, then it's no wonder that we're all rolling in the wrong direction. No matter who's in the White House, no matter who's decided what policies are being followed.
And that's where I'm feeling. Why I said I feel frustrated is because I see behind everything that behind the idea that if Trump's in the White House, he's going to fight for us and fix everything. Behind it is this notion that the government is the solution to everything.
Sure.
And the government's solution to everything is that we somehow get free from all these things. And here's the thing. There's probably some things we ought to be free of.
Yeah.
One of those things may be ourself. But there may be some things we ought to be free of. But the idea of total emancipation is the thing. This is where it's like, I feel like when Christianity got deeply involved in the political culture like it did back in the 70s and 80s in response to a bunch of stuff, when it got involved in a way where it feels like somehow, whether intended to or not, it capitulated to this kind of what is truly an American way of doing things. That's kind of the bigger frustration is that as a Christian, I'm starting to recognize that America is the American ideals and the American way of doing things is in its own way great, but it's still tied up with this emancipation of the individual.
Right, of the
and
individual.
That means I have, as a Christian, a fundamental bone to pick with it in some way.
Well, I can see how that would be frustrating too, because you want to be a supporter of your country. You want to be loyal to your country. America has done a lot of good.
Yes.
We don't want to say that it hasn't. But we don't also want to say my country right or wrong.
Right.
You know, as though you can't critique it, or you know how easy it would be for people on one side of the aisle to hear you say, I have problems with America, and cheer because you are joining them in their leftist, well, you're not doing that.
I'm sorry to disappoint all my Marxist friends out there.
Marxism is a modernist picture. Yeah, it's just like the idea of putting your faith in democracy, and we could just spread democracy around the world.
Or in the free markets.
Or the free, right.
Whatever.
Or that we're going to save the world by becoming communist. That's not going to work either.
Yeah.
All of those things.
I'm sorry. I wasn't even alive during the Cold War necessarily, except for like the last few years of it. And even I find the statement communism will fix everything just funny.
Well, you have a little history lesson. You got to do is look at the 20th century. See, that didn't work.
A little sidebar here. There was last time we went to Europe. I was able to go to Europe with the kids. We went to the British Museum,
right?
And in one of the bathroom stalls, there's like graffiti on the wall, and somebody had written in red pen, "Communism is the only way." And then somebody else had come with a black pen and wrote underneath it, "To starve a nation."
Oh.
It was like,
but you see how easy it is to sort of to fall into a debate over which policy would be better. Would it be better for us to go communist? Would it be better to go free market? Would it be better? All those things become the end of the argument and not the means by which you can accomplish something else.
Right.
And the really great thing you're saying is that a lot of times people, when they do get to means, to ends, the ends that they're actually calling for are autonomy.
Right.
And if that's the case, then that debate is going to go on forever. And no matter who wins, we all lose.
Yeah. If the goal is that kind of total emancipation, which you could say autonomy is kind of total emancipation, then it's no wonder that a society like ours would fragment into tribalism and like fall apart. It's no wonder Facebook would make algorithms that allow us to, without knowing it, completely customize our news feeds to shut out anything that we don't really read or look at. And why wouldn't we want that? You know, it's no wonder we are being emancipated from things we don't want to hear. You know, we don't want this speaker on our college, right? I don't want to see your white child dress up like Moana for Halloween. I want to be emancipated from all these things that offend me or make me feel hemmed in, even if it's something as small and petty as that.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. You said, when people say, well, we need free markets or we need communism, my question to all that is, what do we need them for?
Right.
Like, what are we trying to accomplish here? And I keep feeling like, with the Bush thing, it's like, well, we're going to try and save the world by our beautiful, you know, neoclassical liberal way of doing it. No, can't.
Yeah, right.
Communism, what are you trying to? Well, we're trying to eradicate poverty and crime, and we're trying to save the world through our, our communal collectivist type of centralized. It's not.
It doesn't work.
It's not going to work.
Let's go back to that poverty question for just a second as an example, because, you know, we had a great Sunday night discussion one time a couple of months ago, I guess it was back at late summer, where we were trying to figure out the differences between the call of Jesus to care for the poor and the call of the basic left-wing politician that we have to care for the poor. And it's easy to think on a certain level that those two things could be equated. Obviously, they're both calling for the poor. And the left then can point at the right and say, see, because you guys don't care about the poor, you're actually, not only are you being, you know, bad people on a political level, but you're disagreeing with Jesus, for heaven's sake. You know, I mean, how can you be against Jesus, right? Well, a lot of times that's just a fake argument.
Sure.
I'm not going down that road. But. It was simple, though. I mean, it is tempting to think that those two things—the left's call to feed the poor and Jesus' call—seem to be similar, but they aren't the same thing. And what we began to see is that the left's desire was to eradicate poverty,
right?
And Jesus' desire was to teach us to be selfless,
right?
And the difference there is, I mean, on any particular day, you might see the Christian and the communist both handing a sandwich to somebody, you know? So it looks like they're doing the same thing, but they're doing them for very different reasons. And here's the thing that really came to the fore. If your goal is to eradicate poverty, you're going to be very frustrated.
Right.
Because it's never going to be gone completely,
right?
And so anytime anybody proposes a policy, within the context of this idea of eradicating poverty. Anytime anybody proposes a policy, even if it's completely and perfectly implemented, it's not going to work.
Right.
And so the answer is to then condemn that policy and find something else. See, and so we just go spiraling off into right. left field.
Or even, I can imagine even condemning the poor. Like, the poor just won't get on board.
Oh, well, that's right. From the right, you can just say, well, the whole problem is because the poor right. are not actually taking responsibility for themselves, as though somehow that would eradicate poverty.
Yeah.
Well, that's not going to do it either.
Because we all know that most poor people just don't work hard at all, you know. We all know that.
Right.
They're just lazing around somewhere in Arcadia.
Right. Right. There is such a thing as being irresponsible, but there's a bigger problem here,
yes.
right? And so when Jesus calls us to care for the poor, he cares about the poor, the person. He cares about that person. He wants to see that person benefit and so on. But he also cares about me. And he's telling me, I want you to learn to think of somebody other than yourself.
Right.
That's what I'm really after here. See, you're not going to be able to eradicate poverty, but you can be generous. You can actually be selfless. And in doing so, you become more like Christ. And that's what he wants me to be. So it's a kind of sanctification for me. In that case, I can be successful. You can't be successful if you say my goal is to eradicate poverty, but you can be successful if your goal is to care for the poor.
And Christ-likeness is Christ is what the world needs.
That's
the thing. It's like I say, it's a frustration. The frustration is I am coming to the very startling and terrifying thought that I am a Christian. You know, like above all else,
above all
political loyalties and party loyalties, above even philosophic loyalties,
yes.
I am a Christian. Like that's where it
Amen.
Falls. In my own workings in the university where I'm doing my own work, I have realized over the last like year and a half when I really tried to tackle this postmodern literary thing,
mm-hmm.
you know, trying this post-structural thing, I'm, you know, trying to like, I told you I tried to worm my way inside of it and speak its language and understand it so I can like attack it from the inside rather than the outside. I've realized over the last like year and a half as I've really tried to do it, when push comes to shove, there's no way there's no way I'm not going to ultimately have to let my Christian flag fly.
Mm-hmm.
Like
mm-hmm.
I realized I thought I could avoid that
mm-hmm.
because I felt like if I posited Jesus or something like that, everybody would just be like, oh my gosh, you know, like, oh, well, I'm sorry, this PhD is not academic or something like that. And so I thought,
sure.
is there a way I can talk about Jesus without talking about, like, I can posit like, you know, some sort of dynamic logos thing or something. You know, I could just posit it in some purely sort of academic-y kind of terms that can
sure.
sort of fly under the radar, but it's still there. It's, you know, I've seeded it there so it can blossom. I'm starting to realize the further I push into it, the more I realize, I talked about this with the kids this past Wednesday when we were talking about Aristotle, the mm-hmm. more I push into post-structural philosophy, the more I realize it's the solution to it is the Trinity specifically, you know,
right.
not some sort of bizarre notion of like being that differentiates itself or something
sure.
like that, but the Trinity, just like years ago, I realized the solution to the postmodern problem is incarnation, this idea that we can't purely get past our own subjectivity to the truth, to the pure truth. The truth has to come to us.
Uh-huh.
Right? It has to come to us.
And as a person.
And as a person, it has to be able to relate to us dynamically and personally.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah, I think that's right. It's a radical idea, but the truth turns out to be a person. We, you know, even in on the sort of conservative side of intellectual and political thought, it's still possible to think of the truth as a sort of disembodied set of criteria or factual statements or something like that.
Or an ideal you're trying to reach.
An ideal, like a Platonic ideal even, sure. In all of those cases, though, you're short. It's still an attempt to get at something that's beyond that framework. And the framework itself, without that indwelling person, it will ossify and come apart and go in the wrong directions and eventually crumble. So, yeah, even I think it's really interesting that you're concerned about the that your frustration came up by listening to some sort of more right-of-center politicians because they're making the same mistake that the left-of-center politicians are making, that politics actually is the framework that will make it possible for us to have what we consider to be healthy life. But it's not that. And the truth of the matter is a person.
Yeah.
It's hard to imagine that, but it's really the truth.
It is. It is. And like I said, it's like, I guess that's what I've been realizing politically and philosophically and all that is that, my gosh, I really am a Christian, aren't I? It's like I just really am.
That's where your allegiance really is.
That's where the allegiance really is.
Sure.
And I look around to the left and the right, and I'm like, there's some really sincere, good people on both sides.
Absolutely.
And they're all want these good things necessarily, but fundamentally, they're off.
Yeah.
And it's because, you know, it's because what the world needs is Christ, not Trump. I know that sounds weird, and there's probably people who are like, amen, or something like that. But you understand what I mean.
Yes.
We don't need a strong man. We don't need Bernie.
Right.
It's not what we
it's
need.
It's not just Trump. It's
right?
Bernie.
We don't need Bernie. We don't need Obama. Back in 2008, Obama was Trump. Okay.
Yeah,
this is.
Sure.
I know people will be like, what? But, I mean, think about it. He was the change agent who mongered on a lot of our fears about the nation and said, you elect me and I will be the Messiah who, like, fixes it all.
Absolutely. He bragged about it, that the seas would not encroach any further. He would stop the seas from rising.
Right, and Trump did it in a really bombastic, boorish kind of way, but it was the same exact thing. I'm the change agent who's going to solve all this thing.
Obama's not the solution. That's right.
He's not the solution. But if someone looked at me and said, well, what is the solution? I can only say Christ, and that's it. And that is really, truly a crazy, radical thing to think, that the solution for the poor is not the eradication of poverty, because we can't eradicate poverty.
Right.
The solution for the poor is for them to meet Christ, because Christ is the real solution to the real problem.
Amen.
And that means that we will give them sandwiches and soup lunches, and we'll try to unravel, like, maybe unfair economic practices or something like that. But we'll vote for legislation that seems to actually help without bankrupting everything and wrecking the economy or something like that. But we will never disillusion ourselves to believe that what we're doing is actually going to solve this problem.
Right.
Because the real solution is the need to meet Christ. I sometimes wonder about Mother Teresa, if she understood this, you know, not to bring in I know she had like some weird, she struggled with doubts and darkness and stuff, but I wondered if she didn't realize this, that, you know, the reason I'm over here is not because I'm going to eradicate poverty in India.
Right.
But it's because these people need Christ, you know.
They need to see somebody embodying this Jesus that they need.
They don't just need a sandwich. They need Jesus handing them a sandwich is what they need.
Right.
And that's radical. And that's the thing. Christ is not, how to say this? He's not a political solution. You can't legislate Christ.
Right.
All right. Christ is met on the cultural level in some way. I mean, that's where, I mean, it's a belief being incarnated in the cultural
level. Embodied in a person.
So it's on that cultural level. And it goes back in a way to some things we talked about in earlier podcasts about, like, the idea of mediacy. How, as a culture, we want more immediacy. And that ties into the emancipation thing. You know, the things that mediate what you're doing can just be more stuff that feels like it's shackling you down.
Yeah, it's getting in the way of your having the thing you really want.
And yet it's that mediatory thing that is, is culture. That's where a lot of the changes occur. That's where belief is realized. You said it's made, what was the word you used? You said palatable or like plausible.
Plausible.
I think it's the word. It made it plausible and stuff like that. That's where it actually matters, and that's where it actually lives. It's like, I'm probably speaking way too generally. I have a feeling there's plenty of Christians out there who voted for Trump out of total, whether they voted thinking he would help the country or whether they voted just because they didn't want Hillary because they thought she would be a disaster. Regardless, I'm sure they all did it in good faith, full Christian. This is not questioning anybody's Christianity.
Sure.
This is me recognizing how really radical the Christian view is, because it doesn't fit anywhere in any of our human frameworks. And you can't, if you try to make it fit, if you try to make a truly radical Christian vision fit into Trumpism or fit into the Bush doctrine or fit into the Obama doctrine or whatever, you try to make it fit, you will only do damage to the Christian vision. You'll mangle it instead.
That's right.
Because the
Christian vision is
more radical. It's about Jesus really is the solution that people need, and Jesus is not met in legislation. He's met in people.
That idea is astonishing. It's like we think in two dimensions and the reality is in three.
Yeah.
Or we think in three dimensions and the reality is in eight or something.
Right.
But there are more facets to the Lord himself and to his facility. That's the word for it. Facility. His ability to make these things happen than we have even the smallest notion of. It occurs to me that, you know, T.S. Eliot talked at length about what he called the moral imagination. It's an idea that comes from Edmund Burke, and I think you see it in Irving Babbitt and some other people. Mm. But he talked about the moral imagination, and he contrasted the moral imagination with the idyllic imagination. Mm. And I think what we've got here is that this imagination is like a view of the world. So a moral imagination has, Heath said, three elements. One is that it believes that it has a tragic view of man. Mm-hmm. The idea is that man is sinful inherently and internally and so on, and that the evil of the world is actually in us and not so much just in the systems in the world. Right. The second thing he said is that a moral imagination understands the importance of tradition. That is, that we stand on the shoulders of those who've gone before us, and that we are a part of a long link of a chain of generations that are working in a particular direction, that we need to know where we came from and what they accomplished and what the wisdom that is that they can pass on.
Right.
And then the third thing he said in a moral imagination is that you recognize that you are part of a community. That you need, I guess it's part and parcel of the second one, because you know that you're engaged with those who've gone before you, but you also recognize that you're a part of a spiritual community that is all of those who've died and those who are living and those who are yet born.
A community of souls.
Community of souls, exactly right. And he contrasts that with a kind of Rousseauian picture of the idyllic imagination, which is a kind of utopian imagination that says that the evil of the world is really to be found in the systems in which we live, the political systems, the social systems, the economic systems, the the governmental systems, any of those things. And if we could just tweak those things to get them right, then everything would be okay, and we would have a happy, healthy world, and everybody'd be fine. Well, I think that's underneath this idea that you're talking about, because it seems to me that the description you've given of the speeches you heard and the sort of approach that the Hillary Obama left takes are both coming from that idyllic direction.
Right.
And the moral imagination is one that's informed by Jesus himself, in that he has laid out for us that our real problem is our sinful state, the kind of, how Solzhenitsyn said that the line between good and evil doesn't run between nations or between genders or economic classes. It runs straight through the heart of every man.
Right.
So it's an internal problem that we have to address. And that comes from a Christian revelation, I think.
And I think that's probably why it frustrates people, not just my frustration, but why people who, whether they know it or not, either or they wholesale buy into the idyllic imagination, or whether they know it or not, they just sort of tacitly assume it.
That's it.
In some way, they tacitly assume it.
Yeah.
They get frustrated by the fact that they can't fix it.
Right.
Like whatever the thing, they can't realize this sort of like, well, we fixed all the institutions, or we're trying to, right? We're trying to root out, cronyism. We're trying to root out institutional racism and all this jazz. We're trying to overturn these laws that are bad. We're trying to remove, roll back government regulations or add them or whatever.
Sure.
We're trying to do it. We're fixing and we're doing all of it, and it's not working.
Like, right.
People still do.
Doesn't seem to make any difference.
Doesn't seem to make any difference.
Or people, very little difference.
Or marginal. Like, it's not what
marginal.
You thought it would do.
Yeah, and it creates new problems that are maybe worse than what you had before sometimes.
Right, so there's... It definitely feels like in our culture that there is that tacit idyllic imagination thing, because why not?
Yeah.
Because it makes the problem solvable.
Exactly.
If you can
have control, if you think you can have control over the solution, that's much more preferable than to think that the solution requires my submission to a God that I really can't control and will maybe take me someplace I don't want to go.
That the solution is Jesus realized in your life, and that trusting that Jesus coming through you is going to solve things, and continually coming through you and the community of your community you're a part of is actually going to solve things, requires a kind of real faith. Faith, and by faith, we don't mean a blind, empty thing. We mean trusting that Jesus, A, is there, B, he's really going to show up, and C, he's really going to do something. Something's really, it's almost like that. It's like I'm getting to the point where, like, do I believe this stuff or do I not?
Exactly right.
And I want to ask that question.
I think that's what our culture is actually being forced to. What we're looking at is we're coming more and more to a point. We're saying we're going to have to, fish or cut bait. We're going to have to decide whether we're going with him or we're going with this autonomous goal that's a utopian kind of goal. And everybody's going to have to choose. It's not up until now, we've been able to sort of have a foot in both camps. And now I think we're seeing that we have to make a decision.
The question I ask myself is basically the question I want to ask everybody else is, do you really believe this stuff or do you not?
Yeah.
And it frustrates me. I mean, the reason I'm really worried about this is I feel like I'm not alone out there. I feel like there's a lot of people my age, but even older or maybe younger, who also feel this kind of, they look at the thing and they see none of it's working right or left. And, they're upset that their parents voted for Trump so wholeheartedly. Maybe they're upset that their parents voted for Bernie so wholeheartedly, or Hillary or whoever. And they're upset, they're disillusioned. And I know that disillusioned state can be very dangerous.
Mm.
You can get swept up by all kinds of things. I mean, for some, they may get swept up by like Marxism or something like that, because that's suddenly really popular again. They might get swept up with like a ethno-nationalist type of thing. That got swept
up. Right, kind of alt-right stuff.
For me, it was like a constant having to fight a sort of cynicism.
I was about to say, the real danger is cynicism, isn't it?
Yeah.
That nothing really works and that any solution that you choose is going to be failure, so why bother?
Yeah, it was this kind of cynicism of like, the question was, do we really believe this or not? And my cynicism wanted to say, I'm the only one who does. I look at like friends, family, whatever, and I'm like, you don't really believe Jesus. You don't really believe this stuff is true. I have to fight that. I have to back off of that because I'm like, no, they probably they really do. I'm sure they really do in their own way. But it still doesn't change the fact that I'm recognizing in our culture that we're going to have to ask ourselves that question. Do we really think that Jesus is the actual solution? Yeah. Or are we going to continue to believe that somehow there's a political solution or there's a cultural solution without Jesus? There's people out there who believe that, culture's the solution. We have to take the idea of the emancipated individual and in the arts and in institutions and your religions, to name names or go into a side eddy as it is, but like I feel like certain self-help centered religions are based on the same thing, of emancipated individual. Jesus is a way to emancipate yourself from your problems, financial, emotional, psychological, guilt. The arts have to be about this emancipation, whether you're talking about really crazy, like indecipherable postmodern art that's just solely solely noble to the artist themselves, to the Disney model, going out there, which again, by the way, for those who are wondering, we mentioned Disney model before, but you gotta understand we're both big Disney lovers. Their movies are a lot of fun, but still an attitude of like, I'm going to bust the limits or go out and find myself for realsies or something like
that.
So in the arts it has to be, so there could be this idea that cultural solution, but the cultural solution is to continue to promulgate this thing. And for a Christian, we have to take seriously the idea that Christ is the only solution.
Right?
He really is. He's the thing that has to inform our culture. And in that way, somehow, I mean, maybe that's something to talk about another day, is like how that would influence, like, what would Christ embodied in a cultural way, what would he think about the Second Amendment? How would he really view it, in light of what's happened recently and all the discussions? But how would Christ really look at, like, a welfare thing? I say Christ, but it's not just, like, abstract Christ. It's Christ embodied within us specifically in a particular place and time. And that's a much more complicated thing to come out. So,
well, I think I understand you, that you're not saying that there aren't certain decisions that could be made on a political level that would assist in emancipating people to the point that they could be the people God intended them to be. So, for example, I mean, I would argue that I think a free market actually is a better place than a constricted market by the government to accomplish economic benefit for people. And it allows for the free choices of people to the extent that it does. But it would be foolish for me to think that if I just promulgate free markets everywhere, that somehow everybody will be happy.
Right.
Well, that's foolish. That's crazy.
Right. The Second Amendment, I could say, I believe that, well, we've argued this before, but that the Second Amendment is a way to keep us free.
Right.
Right? It is. It's like, well, then we need it. That's a level of emancipation. That's probably good necessary. I would be a fool if I thought that somehow just rabid, unfettered gun ownership is somehow going to fix everything.
Exactly.
Or it's going to fix all crime. Or
exactly.
Fix all. I don't want to buy into, I can totally buy into the math that if there's somebody, a good guy with a gun somewhere, that they can tip the scales.
Yeah.
But I don't want to buy into the idea that somehow if everyone's armed, all problems go away.
Right.
Like even violent problems.
You could say even in this shooting the other day that it was because of a good man with a weapon that maybe stopped this fellow from doing more damage than he did. So it's not inherently evil to own these guns, but it's not inherently good either. You can't make it into the summum bonum. As soon as you do, then it crumbles and falls apart.
Right.
We make the same argument on an aesthetic level that we don't look to beauty in the world because it in and of itself is good. It's that the beauty is a way for us to see God through the object. Mm-hmm. So the beauty is actually of God. If we stop at the piece of music or the rose or the picture of the Alps or whatever, the statue, then the thing becomes a kind of an idol, and then it'll disappoint us. But if we can look through that thing and thank God for the beauty that we see in the rose, well, then suddenly the rose is a sort of medium, a vehicle through which we can make sense of God.
We've said it here, we've said it Sunday nights to the kids that, you know, there has to be some sort of, for the thing to hold together, there has to be some kind of common vision that everybody holds together on.
Right.
And the thing is as Christians, our common vision is Christ.
That's right.
It's not the Constitution.
Right.
And that's kind of I'm not sure if frustrating is the right word, but it's more kind of, I guess the even better word is kind of the sobering fact, is that the Constitution is a fantastic political work. But it's still a product of fallen people being implemented by fallen people, and it will fail. All right, it will.
That's right, and I even think of it as a tool, sort of like, you want to build a house, and you need a hammer. So the Constitution is the hammer, but the design of the house can't come from the hammer.
Sure,
you have the design from a greater scale, a higher position of authority and vision, and so on. And then the hammer is a means by which you accomplish some of that. You also need screwdrivers and drills and, you know, whatever else, saws and things. But the tool, the Constitution by itself, I mean, I think the writers of the Constitution, Madison was quoted as saying something, this is not going to be quote, but something along the lines of, that if the country ever lost its Christian heritage, then this Constitution wouldn't be worth the paper it's written on. It's not going to hold us to any kind of moral position. It's in itself a reflection of the transcendent realities that he was referring to when he wrote it. So if we hold on to the God beyond the Constitution, then the Constitution can give some framework for our lives. But if we get rid of God and we hold on to the Constitution, then it's going to break and tear and not support us. It's like trying to stand on a piece of wet paper.
And that's probably the heart of the frustration I had been feeling.
Well, I can see the frustration because I know you, and I know you want to have a love of your country and your love of your Constitution and love of your and those things in their proper spots. But you also know that to put all your eggs in that basket would turn you into something that's actually less than what your vision calls for. You want the Lord first, and then if the government or the Constitution can assist in getting you to live out what he's told you to live out, well, then it's worthwhile.
Yeah, and I guess when I look at someone like a Flake,
if it can't, it has to be tweaked.
Right. I look at like a Flake or a Bush, not doubting their sincerity, a lot of people wanted to just really nastily treat Flake for what he said. I didn't doubt his sincerity at all.
Yeah.
I thought he was being very sincere in what he thought was principled in some way, even though he kind of self-immolated on a political level.
Uh-huh.
But that's not always the most important level.
Right.
But I don't doubt their sincerity. If they're claimed to be Christian men, I don't doubt their Christianity. It's just that I look at them, and it seems that they are putting all their eggs in the basket of the Constitution,
sure.
Flake, or with Bush, they're putting all their eggs in the basket of sort of American democracy. And so they're putting all eggs there. Maybe God is like a tacit thing. We keep using that word because it's a great word. You should always use tacit. I recommend tacit. Maybe God
Thank
is like...
Thank you, Michael Polanyi.
Maybe God is like a tacit thing.
Yeah.
Okay, so they're kind of assuming him. So for them, of course it makes sense because God's going to be there, right? I feel like it was almost some of the naivete of Flake as he assumed that everybody understood that his idea of principles was in some sort of context of God or context of like this larger vision of things. And I'm like, there's people out there who don't buy that.
They don't hear that when they hear him say principles. They hear that kind of 50s, I think you mentioned it before we started, the 50s.
He said,
Father knows best kind of
I said that
secularized.
When he said the line, we were most prosperous, we were most principled, I knew, again, because of those progressivist waters I swim in, which is why it's not for everyone, but if you think you have opportunity, you feel you're called there, you should take advantage of swimming in progressivist waters for a while. It could really sharpen you up. I know that when they hear that, they would think the 1950s, which is when America emerged as this big superpower after World War II, and our economy was in a big boom, and it was like we were at our most prosperous then, technically speaking. All right,
right.
It was also a time of Jim Crow. It was a time of McCarthyism. It was a time of... where we get kind of our cliche patriarchal vision of things, you know, father knows best and the women stay at home type thing. You know, Rosie Riveter.
And they vacuum in high heels and pearls. Yeah, I always wondered how they managed
to. Get it. Rosie Riveter, who's that?
You know, lost her altogether, didn't they?
Yeah, we're like the LGBT crowd. This was before Stonewall, I think it was. So they were probably being abused and stuff like that. They would look and say, there was, in your prosperous principled time, you see the air quotes I'm making with my hands? Right? In your prosperous principled time, there was some bad stuff going on. And they would point at that and say, ha, you're a stupid prince. But they would say, your principles mean nothing because you caused all this. And I want to say the principles have some value. It's just that they're not the sunum bonum. They're not the greatest thing.
That's right.
They're just not.
Right, right. And the principles may be very good, but that doesn't imply that everything about the society at the time that is implementing those principles is going to be successful or even... not hypocritical. I mean, there's going to be hypocrisy because we've got human beings in every case.
I
think that's a temptation to want to have either all or nothing. I call that the all or nothing fallacy.
Sure.
You either think, well, the 50s were the perfect time, and if we could just get back to that time, well, then that's what conservatism was really about, going back to a kind of golden age, which it's not.
No.
Or on the other hand, look at all the bad things that were happening then. All of that stuff was just that you're calling good and principled was just a facade of hypocrisy, and underneath was all this evil going on. And so we should dump all of your principles.
Right.
Well, neither of those is very successful. And I think it assumes the idyllic imagination, see? It assumes that if the systems are the problem, then one side is claiming the systems were fine, let's go back to them, and then call that conservatism. The other side is saying the systems were rotten to the core, and we should reject them, and they call that liberalism or left progressivism, whatever you want to say. But both of them bought into the same idyllic imagination.
Sure. And even on the left, they have their, arguably, they have their, like, idyllic golden age, too. Maybe like the 60s and 70s or so when all their revolutions were happening.
Right.
When I listen to, like, or read, like, some older-ish, or people who remember, progressivists who remember that time, they get really frustrated today. Mm. All right, mm-hmm. There's a guy named Robert Scheer who has a podcast called Scheer Intelligence, and he's an old school lefty. All right, and I listen to his podcast because you ought to listen to leftists,
very good
leftist people. You ought to listen to them, even if you're going to disagree with them. And there's been plenty of times I disagree with them, but there was this podcast he had recently with a guy whose name I can't remember. It was like Erwin Chermanowski or something like that. He's a law professor at Berkeley.
Okay.
And they were talking about free speech, which, you know, Berkeley and free speech has been kind of a thing these days because Antifa has made themselves known so there. And Scheer was like, he's this old school, pushing 80 years old, progressivist guy. And he was super frustrated that there were all these kids in university who are supposed to be teaching getting liberal progressive values, and they don't like free speech. And he's like, and he's really upset. He's like, free speech is a part of the Constitution. Why aren't we teaching kids these things anymore? Camille Paglia, who's like a big feminist writer.
Right.
She doesn't understand what happened to feminism, why it's gotten so crazy in her idea. Uh-huh. Like, they're like, what happened to the 60s and 70s when we were about freedom and emancipation and stuff? When did we become about silencing people and shutting them down and stuff like that? Everybody has their idyllic thing. Everybody gets frustrated. So the right could look at them and say, aha, your attempts to emancipate women. And the thing is that either we have the city of God or we have the city of man. If we have the city of man, then we have to be Ra's al Ghul and we got to burn it all down because, you know, it just doesn't work. It's not perfect enough. And it's this notion of how can we recognize that we live in a city of man, but that doesn't mean we have to hate it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. And that's really, in a way, the trick. You know, if I really recognize I live in a city of man because some progressivist government is in charge and, if we could just get a Republican in there, it'll make it city of God again or something like that.
Right.
It's always going to be a city of man. It's always going to be imperfect, flawed. In some ways, its central belief is always going to be flawed.
Yeah.
Augustine, in the City of God, his book where he deposits these two things, said that the key trait of, like, the city of God is grace, mainly through Christ-likeness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the key trait of the city of man is what in Latin he called the libido dominandi, which if you were Nietzschean, you'd call it the will to power.
Sure.
All right? It's this idea of, like, asserting the self over everybody else.
Yeah.
And the emancipation, total emancipation of the individual, that autonomy, is that same kind of idea.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, it's like, why should we be surprised that our city of man, and that's what America is, all right? It's like, I wish... And I feel like if I said this, they would agree. But I would really, you Christians out there, you really need to understand this. America is a city of man. It will fall one day. It's not perfect. If there are bumps and stuff, it's not because those other guys are screwing up. The line of good and evil does not run between progressive and conservative,
right,
or between Trump supporter and Trump hater or whatever. That's not where it runs. It runs through us. Of course, we're fallen. Of course, this thing is going to be stupid no matter who is running it, no matter who's in charge, no matter what policies get
passed. So the very best, actually, the very best government is still going to have crumbling foundations and eventually fall. We've seen it in the Roman Empire. We've seen it in the British Empire. We've seen it in the American, I think, too. Now we're looking at the end of it. And I don't mean to say that we can't do some things that would bring it back to stronger foundations. The actual step toward the stronger foundation is to reject the notion that politics is the answer to the problem.
And even to buy into, I don't know, Tolkien would call it a bit more northern courage, but what he means is the idea of, like, we're not going to fight for this thing because we think we can win. All right?
The kind of Norse idea. Gotcha.
And now someone's going to accuse us of white nationalism, but anyways, that's just more of the stupid political culture.
It's the idea that something is worth fighting for even if you lose.
Yeah, and what I mean by that is, to say that America is a city of man, it's flawed, and eventually it's going to fall apart and crumble, that's just the way it is, that is not an excuse to not fight for the good.
Amen.
In the midst of it. That's not an excuse. The elves in The Lord of the Rings talked about fighting the long defeat.
Yes.
This idea that they were ultimately going to lose in some way, but they are still going to fight. They were still going to fight, and they're still going to stand because the good is the good, and that's just it. It's like,
the good is worth fighting for in every case.
If you believe the Constitution is all there is, and then you realize, well, just historically speaking, it's probably going to fall apart, why would you fight for it? It's like, it really is something that's just going to, like, collapse. It's not going to last. And even or not just that it's going to collapse or something like that, but it's really an idyllic piece of something that can't be realized. So the cynical approach, you know, it can't really be realized, so I'm just going to check out.
Right.
There has to be a way where you can shoot the gap in a way between this all or nothing, sort of like, if we don't have it perfect, burn it all down, or if we don't have it perfect, it's the other guy's fault, and if we just did it my way, it's somehow mm-hmm. where somehow to recognize we live in a city of man. It's fundamentally flawed. America is, even in its constitution that wanted to posit a God as a context for it, is still fundamentally based on these Enlightenment ideas that is fundamentally flawed and not fully in simpatico with Christian thinking.
That's right.
How can, that's can, right. Is there a way to believe that this is a city of man, but still not hate the place?
Amen. Amen.
You know, to still believe that this is some place worth fighting for.
And the way to, and it seems to me the way to do it is to recognize that this world is not all there is. If you're fighting for, if the elves are fighting a losing battle, if they're fighting that long defeat, you say, they are thinking in the back of their minds, I know that I can go to the Grey Havens and I can sail to heaven, basically.
Valinor remains.
Valinor is still there, and it's eternal. It's not going anywhere, no matter what happens here. However, we can, in this world, have an effect on Valinor's part for making this world as good a place as it can be. But it's if you walk into it thinking, I'm a failure unless I make it all happen here, make heaven happen here, basically. It's just a crazy idea. It's an underestimation of the depth of evil. Bill Buckley, at one time, I remember, threatened to make a bumper sticker that said, don't immanentize the eschaton. It sounds like Buckley, doesn't it?
Yes. You might want to unpack that for some.
Don't immanentize the eschaton. Don't take the eschaton, which is the last, the end of things, the telos.
Like eschatology,
right? The last days, and don't take the new heavens and the new earth, and try and make them imminent now,
right?
Because you can't do it. That does not mean. I think you made this point already, but it doesn't mean that we don't take what we know is the right way to live and live it out here and better this world and be salt and light in this world and influence this world. We pray it all the time in the Lord's Prayer. We say, Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. It's already done in heaven the way you want it to be. We're praying that we can be a part of what you're doing here, you see. We're not taking away from that at all.
No.
But it doesn't mean that we can accomplish it on our own by political means or by any means,
right.
Economic means.
To think otherwise is to fall back in the all or nothing thing, which is...
That's right.
Which is, if we can't fix it, then if we can't really solve it, well, then I guess we should do nothing. Now, shouldn't we?
Yeah.
And it's like, that idea stems from the same place of it's all on us.
Right.
It's all on us. If you don't believe there is something greater... Not just that there's a God, okay? A deist can posit a God, but that there is a Christian God.
Yeah.
A God who has invaded our world and has a redemptive plan that is building a city of God that is bigger than all the cities of men, and it can never be stopped.
Right.
As long as you have that vision, well, then you can do good without ever believing you're going to save the world.
That's right.
And I feel like that attitude of I can do good and never delude myself into thinking that I'm going to save the world, or that my party can save the world, or that my nation can save the world,
or my gender, or my economic class, or my LGBTQ partners. Right. Or my whatever group you've joined up with.
Right.
None of those is going to save the world. None of those is going to save the world. It can't be done through those means.
But I can still do good. I can still do something good.
I can be
good.
Obedient. God seems to care about how we live our lives. He does care about what we do and where we go and how we might live in conjunction with one another. To love him and to love our neighbors is the goal of human life in this world. Well, he wants us to learn to do those things because that makes us more like him and glorifies him.
Because he's not trying to build any specific nation. He's trying to build a kingdom.
No, he's building a kingdom. And yes, maybe we can build a nation in the short run that reflects some of those values. And I think our founders did reflect some of those values.
Sure.
However, I think the wisest of them knew that that was not going to actually accomplish God's ends. It was only going to provide a kind of safe place for people to live out what God intended them to live out. But the picture that God is going by, the design he's going by, is much more profound and much more subtle than anything we could have come up with, even in our best days. Well, I'm grateful for the question. I think you're really wrestling with something very important there. And I too think I'm sympathetic with the sincerity of people on both sides sometimes. I hear people on the right, like you said, like Flake, being sincere, but mistaken about the weight he's putting on his own theories. But I hear it from the left too. I find myself being sympathetic with people who are who long to see justice done, or long to see what they call social justice, or the end of the oppression of women, or the end of poverty and so on, and crime. I'm sympathetic with them that those are genuine and sincere mm-hmm. desires on the part of most people.
Yeah.
But I think they're often mistaken about the policy they think is going to help bring their goals around.
And that's because you take Christ seriously.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
As Lewis said, at some point we're going to have to let our colors show, some of our Christian colors show. Well, I think we can go into recommendations. I have two, actually. I had only one, but in the process of talking, I thought of two. So the one I thought of in the middle of talking, as I mentioned, Robert Shear's podcast, Shear Intelligence.
Yes.
I think his last name is S-C-H-E-E-R,
okay.
I think. But okay. Like, look him up, Robert Shear, and then whatever his last name is, look for a podcast called Shear Intelligence, okay. Where he talks to what he calls American originals. He thinks like original thinkers and stuff like that. There is an episode from a while back. I want to say it was actually maybe last year, but if you can find it, like if you search on iTunes and the podcast for like Shear Intelligence, and the episode is titled Matt Walsh. Mm-hmm. MattWalsh. Matt Walsh is a libertarian. And I remember that episode well, not necessarily in detail, but just that Robert Shear often brings on people he agrees with, or people who, you know, ostensibly agree with him. Sometimes uh-huh. they can surprise him.
Uh-huh.
But for the most part, agree with him. But he brings on someone who, on a fundamental level, he's an old school lefty. Matt Walsh is a straight up libertarian, and they disagree. And they had a civil disagreement with each
other. Wow, terrific.
All right, there was no shouting, there was no screaming, there was no assuming the worst of the other person's motives. It was a very clear, civil, I don't agree with this. There's this. Well, yeah, we have to think about this. Yes, but we also think. So if you want an example of good civil disagreement, look up this podcast called Shear Intelligence. You have to look up what Robert Shear's last name is spelled. Look up Shear Intelligence and try to find an episode. It's from a while ago, so you may have to search for it. But it's an episode about Matt Walsh, who was the person he was talking to. That was one thing. Now, the second thing, which was my original recommendation, so I can't let it go. But my original recommendation, we talk about heavy things here and, you know, deep and heavy stuff, but lighter stuff is always good too. So I'm going to recommend Thor Ragnarok.
Oh, the movie.
For the movie, for anyone who wants to go see it. It is definitely, I'm going to say, it's definitely not like incredibly profound, but it's not trying to be. It is just fun.
Uh-huh.
It is just so much. There was a part in the movie, and if you see the movie, you know what I'm talking about, where the spaceships are trying to get to the portal in the sky, and there's a big laser shootout fight in the sky while they're trying to get there. I remember sitting there with my wife, and I like told her later, I said, at that moment in the movie, I suddenly realized, my gosh, I'm having so much fun right now. It is just fun, okay? It has a lot of good moments, sure, some pretty touching moments, but it's not like a deep, heavy thing.
Sure.
It's really solid, good, made fun. So sure. If you are kind of getting tired of the heaviness of the world and the heady stuff, you need a break and a breather that's not just pure. It is amusement, but it's a good kind of amusement. It's like a it's a break from musing. All right, go get some amusement. Go see Thor Ragnarok. It's a whole lot of fun. It's definitely the best Thor movie, and most people are saying it's probably one of the top 10, top 5 movies Marvel's made so far.
Hmm.
I'm not going to argue that, but I will say it's lots of fun. Thor Ragnarok, go see it.
Very good, very good. Well, I could give a movie recommendation, too. It's an old movie, but it's a movie called The Spitfire Grill. We watched it with our students the other night, and we're going to have a discussion about it Sunday night. We're going to try and talk about it just before dinner with those who were here last week. And it's an excellent film. I just recommend it. I won't tell you anything about it. It's just a very good film to watch. It's one to ponder and to consider and think about. It's not got any laser.
I've seen it. It's a very soft film.
Right. There's hardly any aliens in it or any explosions.
Hardly at all.
hardly any. But it's a very good and touching film. I think it's a well-crafted piece of work. And then for a book, let me tell you, I've been you know, since it's the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, mm-hmm. I have been asked to do some lectures recently about the influence over the last year. I've been doing lectures about the influence of the Reformation on the arts and on philosophy. And so I want to recommend a book I've been reading called The European Reformations by Carter Lindberg, L-I-N-D-B-E-R-G. And so far, anyway, I haven't completed the whole, it's a big book, but the bits that I've read are terrific. They're sound history, and they talk about the influences of these various ideas on politics, on the arts to a degree, and on philosophy, the influence. I'm particularly interested in the Reformation and the influence of the Reformation on the Enlightenment, and what kind of connections there are, and what whether we're drawing straight lines from the Reformation to the Enlightenment, or whether there are broken lines. But at any rate, he does a good job of kind of giving you the background. So Lindberg's, his name is Lindberg, Carter Lindberg, and the book is The European Reformations.
Very good. Well, that's all the time we have for today. I've been Jack Vowell. This is John Hodges, joined as always by John Hodges. This has been the From the Center podcast, and we'll see you next week.
See you next time.